This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. On August 29th, 1958, in Gary, Indiana, a music legend was born. Almost exactly 4 months later, the greatest game ever was played. Now, this week's guest had a path crossing both a music profession and a football profession. The thing is, this week's guest and that music legend, born in 1958, have the same name. And that name is Michael Jackson.
Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. Your host is Arnie Chapman. Football is his passion, and he wants you to come along with him to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board his DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. Great
Scott. This time as we step off the DeLorean, the date is December 26th, 1976, to watch the NFC Championship game between the Los Angeles Rams and the Minnesota Vikings. The reason why we're here is because this is the first NFL memory, for this week's guest. And as I alluded to, this week's guest is Michael Jackson. You know, not the, not that guy. However, maybe he busted out a few times because our MJ was also a professional musician. But to leave out some of the confusion, here's the first paragraph from the bio of his page. Quote, "My name is Michael Jackson, but I write under the name Jackson Michael. I grew up in Wisconsin cheering for the Packers, the Tom Landry, Coach Dallas Cowboys, the Love Ya Blue era Houston Oilers, and the Dan Reeves, John Elway-led Denver Broncos." End quote. So there you go. He goes by Jackson Michael, not Michael Jackson, so to get rid of all that confusion. But to give you an idea of being a Packers fan, you know me as a Lions fan and all, that's touching on some treadly water there. He even named his dog Lambo, so you know what he's all about. Now, speaking of the Packers, you get to hear a fanboy moment from Michael really near the beginning of this interview, where he got to talk to Bart Starr. But that's just one of the many legends of the game that he was able to interview throughout the, well, we'll talk about the book that he gets into. But first, I'm going to peel behind the curtain, because after I stopped recording this interview, now we had just a great conversation about, one story was Bart Starr and how he wished he would have asked him some questions, and then he called Starr back, and then Bart told him he appreciated how he took the time to call him back and get it right. Something that I really wish I would have had on recording there, because this and many other stories that we ended up talking about, because just went back and forth, just really wish I would have recorded them. I know, rookie mistake. But the reason why I brought Michael on this show was to discuss some of his stories covering the history of the game. He started it all off with a book that he released in 2014 called The Game Before the Money, Voices of the Men Who Built the NFL. And since then, well, he's continued to work on many other projects revolving around sports history. He is also the host of The Game Before the Money podcast, you know, a spinoff of the book. And he is the host of the Texas Sports Hall of Fame podcast. He's also an author of a newly released book called Red, White, and Columbia Blue, Chasing the Dream with the 1979 Houston Oilers, and also put together a Love Ya Blue documentary. To learn more about Michael's work, including more than I've just discussed here, you can head over to thegamebeforethemoney.com. But speaking of the book, before we get into this interview, Michael is going to give away an autographed copy of the Game Before the Money book to one lucky winner. All you have to do to sign up is to head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/contest. And while you're over there, a reminder, the best way, if you want to get more than one entry with just one email address, all you got to do, share it with as many friends as you can. There's some other ways to get more entries over there as well. But with all that said, how about we get into the interview? And again, that's with Mr. Michael Jackson. But the first thing I kind of wanted to get into is, what's your first memory of an NFL game?
The first memory I have of an NFL game is sitting at my grandparents' house watching a fuzzy connection to the NFC Championship game in 1976. It was the Rams and Vikings. The Rams were lining up for a field goal, and the Vikings blocked it. and ran it back for a touchdown. And that's my first memory of watching NFL football. And it was quite memorable. Special teams touchdown. I mean, not everybody can say that's their first NFL memory.
Right. Yeah. And that's why would that, of all games, why did that stick in your mind? Because of the special teams or just because the age or because of who you were with? I mean, what was it?
No, it's just the first that I can remember. And I've since looked it up. I knew the Rams and Vikings were playing in a playoff game. And over the years, I had to go back and look it up. And it was the NFC Championship game to go into Super Bowl 11. And that's the first Super Bowl I remember. I remember watching that with my parents.
As a Lions fan, we don't get too many of the playoff appearances, but I remember the early 90s. I always forget if it's 92 or 93 for some reason, but the one when the Lions actually won a playoff game and they ended up going further on and then they lost the next week by a lot. I just remember my dad and, you know, not being too happy. Now, the story goes, he punched a hole in the wall, but I don't really know if that was true or if I manufactured it in my head because I was kind of younger at the time. But that's something. It's funny how we always remember certain things. And I mean, have you been a fan then your whole life as far as the NFL goes and football?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I was, I guess, 6 years old when that Rams-Vikings game and Super Bowl 11 happened. I can vividly remember being in third grade and Super Bowl 13 between the Cowboys and Steelers happening. I just got hooked early on. It was great. I really enjoyed it. We loved playing football as kids in the yard. We'd pretend that we were our favorite players, and it just kind of grew from there. It was just something I was always enjoyed watching football, and I was one of those guys who kind of was able to remember everything, stats, players, happenings, obscure plays like a blocked field goal ran back for a touchdown, 40 years ago.
Right. Yeah. Those types of things that some people just watch the game and they don't remember the obscure ones. But like you said, you can remember them. And I too remember just growing up. I remember we were trying to watch the Lions game. We can't get the blackout games, when you're so far, you're so close to the stadium and they don't sell out, you can't get the TV there, but we could pick it up from way up in Cadillac, Michigan. And my dad will go up on top of the TV or the roof with an antenna, trying to move it around, yelling down to my sister to yell to me, "Can you see the picture?" And he's up there with ice and stuff. So yeah, the things that we'll do to watch the games and sports that we love and such. And I mean, you're able to watch so many different types of games, but then the reason why I brought you on the show was because of a book that you wrote, the Game Before the Money. What was the reason for that? What was your thought there?
Yeah, The Game Before the Money is an oral history of pro football. So it's interviews with players who played from the 30s through the 70s. And I was inspired by a baseball book from the 1960s called The Glory of Their Times, where Lawrence Ritter, he drove around the country finding these baseball players who had played around the turn of the century, like during Ty Cobb's time, guys who had played with Ty Cobb even. And it's just this great, the glory of their times. It was such a great piece of American history and such an important document of the game. And I felt somebody needed to do that for football as well. So I didn't plan on being that person. It just kind of all sort of happened.
Why players? You said 30s through the 70s when they played. Why that era?
Well, the 30s was, I found a couple of people alive, one actually, who had played in the 1930s. That was as far back as I could find someone to interview that was still alive when I started the project in 2011. And that was Chuck Cherundolo. He played center for the Steelers. He's on the Steelers all-time legends team. He had some priceless stories about going to Penn State in the 30s. And he was on the Cleveland Rams, if you can believe that. So yeah, it was important to capture that stuff while these guys were still around. And through the 70s, you know, I didn't want to get too much into the free agency era because that's when the money really started to happen. But before that, you know, as you've probably covered on your show, you know, guys were working jobs in the off season, even star players. You know, Bart Starr he started working at a car dealership, he told me. He later worked for Ford doing promotions. Bob Greasy sold real estate. If you could imagine playing in two straight Super Bowls and then selling real estate in the offseason. In fact, if you watch John Taylor's game-winning touchdown at Super Bowl 23, if you find the clip on YouTube, the announcer says how John Taylor sells cars in the offseason after he makes the touchdown. So, you know, it was a different time and it was a different era. And so I wanted to cover that, the pre-free agency era when players were, you know, more in the social economic level of, you know, like our parents, you know, people working regular, you know, 40-hour a week jobs.
Yeah, I remember, I can't recall which guest it was because I've talked about Johnny Unitas multiple times throughout the show, of course. And he talked about Johnny Unitas and his team working down at the docks, and it's just kind of crazy, like you said, that it's the game for the money. We'll tie that back in. So now it makes sense, of course, why the 30s through the 70s that you'd write the book about.
Yeah, and I actually talked with one of his teammates, a couple of his teammates, but one in particular, Tony Lorick, who was a excellent running back for the 1960s Colts in the mid 1960s. He worked as a beer distributor. So yeah, they were all working jobs like that, you know?
Yeah, definitely a different time. And you mentioned going back to another pretty famous quarterback, Bart Starr. So you had a chance to interview him?
Yeah, I did. I met him at a sports card autograph, you know, an autograph show. And yeah, I mean, I grew up in Wisconsin, so I always tell people getting to meet Bart Starr was like getting to meet Abraham Lincoln. You know, yeah, he agreed to do the interview. He gave me a phone number to call, not his personal number for his office. He gave me, and yeah, I got to ask him. You know, he was really gave a great backstory to his career because he didn't even play his junior and senior years at Alabama. And that's one of the amazing things about Bart Starr and his career was he was injured his entire junior year, and his senior year, they had a new coach who benched all the seniors because he wanted to play newer players that would be there longer. So as it turns out, the Alabama basketball coach knew someone who worked for the Packers, said, you know, gave a high recommendation about who Bart Starr was as a person. And he was a great man outside of the football field. And yeah, the Packers took a chance on him. I think in the 17th round, something like that, late teens. And he really didn't have that good of a chance of making the team, he said. And he said he just worked really, really hard, harder than he had ever worked in the offseason to make the team. And thankfully for Packers fans, and probably not for Lions fans as much, but yeah, he turned out, that's a really great story. And that's another thing why I really like getting into people's life stories is it's really inspiring because against those odds, Bart Starr, you know, became quarterback of one of the greatest teams in NFL history.
Yeah, and I never heard that story before, how he was benched as a senior. And, you know, getting injured, okay, that's different. That happens. But getting benched as a senior because some coach comes in and wants to, you know, he wants to build for the future. I'm using air quotes here, just like you would in professional ranks. And then to go against those odds, to have somebody take a chance to say, hey, you should give this guy a go. And then, boom, now he's, you know, well, passed on. But he's gold jacket, Hall of Famer, bronze bust kind of guy. That's a crazy story. And that's why it's so neat to be able to talk to these people. I mean, you had a heavy hitter type of list of interviews, I would say. I mean, who are some other ones that really stuck out in your mind personally?
Yeah, it really went further than I could ever imagine. You know, some of the other players, I got to chat with Frank Gifford, you know, a lot of the old Cowboys like Walt Garrison, Dan Reeves, Leroy Jordan, you know, several of the Lombardi Packers, Jim Taylor, Paul Hornung, and Mick Tinglehoff, Carl Eller from the Vikings, Yale Larry, who's a Hall of Famer for the Lions, you know, and guys I grew up, you know, knowing about in the 70s, like Louis Kelcher from the Chargers, and Rocky Blyer, you know, from the Steelers, and Bob Greasy. And but, you know, also I wanted to make sure that I got interviews with people who weren't the biggest stars on their team. You know, guys like Tony Lorick, who were important parts of who was an important part of those Colts teams in the mid 60s, and what it was like to be in the huddle and being in the starting lineup with guys like Johnny Unitas and Lenny Moore. What it was like, you know, to be somebody, you know, playing for a championship team or a team that made the NFL championship, and not being the superstar.
So who was your first interview and how did you fall into that?
Yeah, the very first was Chuck Cherundolo. I called him over the phone. I got a hold of him. His son was a judge. So I found his son's number online and he put me in touch with his father. So that was the very first, but everything really started. I called for him after I had been playing as a professional musician was my career. So I had no idea I was even going to do this. I just thought it was a really important thing. And I hoped that somebody would someday document the lives of these players who built the NFL. And I was playing a gig and I just happened to start talking with the guy who is the artist for the Texas Sports Hall of Fame. His name is Robert Hurst. And we just struck up a conversation. He started mentioning that he knew Night Train Lane. Well, Night Train Lane was still alive. And I said to him, wow, you know, I really wish I would have known you then, because, you know, I really, and I told him about my idea and he's like, well, that sounds really great. Do you want to go to Bob Lilly's golf tournament at the Texas Sports Hall of Fame? You know, you can meet some of the guys there and maybe get some interviews. And at Bob Lilly's golf tournament, that's when it really started. That's where I met Kenny Houston. I met Walt Garrison and I met Elvin Bethea, and I set up interviews with them. And Walt was really where it all started. I had called Mr. Cherundolo a night or two before I met with Walt, but I drove up to Walt's ranch and sat down with him for a couple of hours, and that's really where it started. He then put me in touch with Dan Reeves, and you know, by then I had you know, enough credibility, if you will, where I could say I had interviewed Garrison and Reeves and Elvin Bethea, and I kind of had my confidence up that I could ask people for interviews, and that's really where it started to roll.
Huh? Yeah, I have like so many follow up questions now with this, but the first one I'll have to have is, how did you choose the other guests or guests? How did you choose the other interviews then moving forward? Was it by chance, or did you have a specific plan, or how did that go?
Part of it was by chance, who I was put in touch with. Like, for example, Robert Hurst, the artist, he also met Goose Goslin one night, who was the first member of the Denver Broncos and is in the Broncos Ring of Fame. He told him about me, and Goose, you know, had me call him up. And then, you know, there were times where I went to autograph shows and I would ask people for interviews. And that's, how I got interviews with like Billy White Shoes Johnson and Frank Gifford and players like that. And other players, you know, I felt like I was really meant to do this and that it was really important to do. And, I would just try to find their phone numbers, you know, through the white pages on the internet. Sometimes some of them have businesses. And I'd find a phone number that way. And, I'd connect with, people like that. I'm very grateful for everybody who is a part of it, because I really feel like I am very fortunate to because I'm like everybody else, I'm a fan. I say I'm the fan who kind of got to sneak into the locker room and talk to the players after the game, you know.
Yeah, how long has the book been out now for?
It came out in 2014. In the fall of 2014.
So you started it what, 2-3 years or so before then, or when would you have started it?
It started in 2011, summer of 2011, is when I went up and met with Walt Garrison, and then met with Elvin Bethea later.
Okay, so then that's going to somewhat transition into one of your next ventures in life, because you've had more, so 10 years, we'll call it, worth of almost of covering the sport, the history of football and that kind of thing. What's the, now knowing more about football history than you would have been during that time, what's the one guest or one interview that you wish you would have had in the book that maybe would have given you a different perspective?
Oh, well, I tried really hard to get an interview with Joe Montana, and it just never worked out. So that would be, he would be really high up there on my list, because I put the chapters in chronological order from when their careers started. So he would have been the last chapter in the book, and I thought it would have just been great, but it didn't really work out. It never got on the phone with him at the same time. So, I tried calling a number for Y.A. Tittle several times, and no one ever picked up. So,
well, I mean, sometimes it's a grind trying to find guests for your or interviews for, I keep saying guests because I'm thinking podcast mode, but interviews for your book and such. But we're going to go back again when I said I had a follow-up question. So you said you were a full-time a professional musician. First of all, what type of music and what instrument did you play in there?
Yeah, guitar was my primary instrument. I started playing as a teenager, and really, that's all I really wanted to do was play music. And I just had a natural ability to do it. I ended up playing several other instruments. I learned a lot of different instruments. I learned that, you know, to really make a so-called living out of it, you have to have a lot of versatile skills, and you have to be able to play a lot of different kinds of music. My favorite kind of music to play is rhythm and blues, blues music. That's my favorite kind to play, but yeah, you know, I played everything from country to gospel to, whatever, you know, singer songwriter music.
So because you had that background, did that get brought up ever in any of your interviews to kind of core, I don't know. It's hard to really, you're playing in front of people. They're playing a football game in front of people. to feed off of that energy. Did you ever have that conversation with any of the athletes?
Not really. I didn't. I remember reading an interview with Jerry Rice, I think, while he was playing. And he said that he's so focused on the game, he didn't even notice the crowd. And yeah, it is different when you're on stage. A lot of times you're doing other things. I might be changing, setting on my amp, or, talking to a band member about, what the next song is going to be, or something like that. So a lot of times, I've heard, like with Jerry Rice, that, you don't focus on the crowd so much, and it's like that performing too. So
get in the zone or the sweet spot or whatever they want, or whatever you want to call it, flow.
Yeah, maybe that's it. But you just, that might be part of it. You're focused on what you're doing, and in the NFL, you have to be focused on running a route, more than the fans, or you're going to get hit pretty hard. if you lose focus for a second, or you'll drop a pass and have the fan base questioning your starting role.
Or the players that you were talking to, considering that the defensive penalties weren't there during that time frame, you get your head taken off and no one would sniff at it. But,
yeah, Carol Dale, who played for the Packers, and the Rams, he came up in 1960, I think was his rookie year, 60 or 61. And he was talking about some of the rules, face masking had just been, put into the rule book, just a few years before he came up. Clotheslining, was legal until, in the college all-star game. And Carol talks about this in the book, in the college all-star game, a college player got hit and, clotheslined and actually swallowed his tongue. And so that led to making that a penalty. So, and down by contact is another thing. I mentioned that in my newest podcast about the 1948 NFL championship. And you can find the play on YouTube where the Eagles threw a long pass. It looks like it's a touchdown, that it ended up being called back by penalty. But to us, it looks like the player was down, because he was hit and he fell down. But in those days, you actually had to hold a player down to tackle him. There was no down by contact back then. So that rule came in later too. Down by contact, and the ball used to be placed where the knees fell rather than where the ball fell. That's another, that's why sometimes you see, I think receivers catching the ball kind of, straight and having their knees fall exactly where the ball is.
Yeah. It's just one of those things that just transforms and evolves the game. And then also things around it, including, you alluded to it, your podcast, the mediums have changed, not newspapers anymore and books. Let's talk about the podcast. What is the podcast about that you're discussing, and why did you start it?
Yeah, the podcast is really just an extension of the book. It's an oral history of football. And, there's just so much work to be done and so many stories to collect. And, I just really enjoy it. And, I know other fans do too. I mean, for us, it's our only outlet to getting the stories is through interviews and reading about them and books. And, it's really important to document, I think everything about the player, their life, how they made it into pro ball, what they've done afterwards. And I think it's really great having it in a podcast form because you can actually hear the player speaking and telling the story. And it gives it a little bit, it's a little bit more heavy that way, I think.
Yeah, I agree. When I say you're taking a walk or you're in the car or whatever it is, and you have the earbuds in and you're listening to whatever, if it's an interview or whatever it is of that, say we'll call it a player being interviewed, and it sounds like they're talking to you and like they're at the bar with you telling their story about what they did 50 years ago with Vince Lombardi was my coach and I played with Bart Starr and all these things. And it's almost like that theater of the mind goes in a different way to that game, even though I've never been there. I mean, I wasn't born back then. A book is great, but then that's in my own theater of the mind almost, but him telling me is different because it's like a combination. I don't know what it is, but that spoken word does give something different. Plus when somebody's been a little tenured on this planet, they have that kind of raspy, you know, good seasoned voice and they just feels like they're back in the day. And then you can hear that quiver when they stop to remember that moment or whatever it is. And that kind of makes me think about, okay, so going through all your interviews, your stories, whatever it was, when you're talking to a player, what's that one moment where you were asking them a question, they came back at you with a story that just, I don't know, blew your socks off, like you never expected that to be the answer?
Oh, okay. Yeah. One just really popped into my head. And I had found out that in going through box scores, before I interviewed Carl Eller, who played defensive end for the Minnesota Vikings, I'd found out that coincidentally, he had a fumble recovery for a touchdown right before Jim Marshall's infamous wrong way fumble recovery, where he ran it back to his own end zone for a safety. And so I asked Carl about that, and he was kind of surprised that I knew that. He was like, wow. He was like, nobody remembers that. And then what blew me away was he said, yeah, when Jim picked up the ball, he said, my first thought was, gosh darn it, he's going to have a longer touchdown than I am. And so I said, so Carl, you didn't realize that he was running the wrong way either? And he said, no. He said, that play was crazy. We got turned around 3 or 4 times. You know, so it really gave insight to that play, because a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of fun at Jim Marshall's expense because he ran the wrong way and people are like, yeah, you know, what a big mistake and everything. But, you know, hearing it from his teammate who was on the field for the play saying like, yeah, we just got turned around a few times. The play was, you know, we were following the ball. You understand how he just picked it up and ran to daylight, as the phrase is, and didn't realize he was running the wrong way.
Yeah. I mean, it's different when you're in the moment and you're on the field versus us as a fan, even watching it however many years later on a TV and stuff like that. It's totally different. And I even marvel at like a coach, a head coach that's standing on the sidelines and what they're able to see when I can't even see the same thing they're seeing up on the TV screen. Granted, I know that that's what their job is, and of course they should, but it's just to me amazing, and I marvel at it. And in the book itself, I mean, it's been out for, we'll call it, what, 7 years almost. If you could write a 30-second promo that, you know, they have those YouTube ads and all that stuff, a 30-second promo, like, what would your promo be to explain what this book is about and to get somebody's interest in it that maybe never heard of some of these players or the game before the money?
Yeah, well, it's football history through the eyes of the actual players and players who played the game as the league was growing. And so you get a history of the game from that vantage point. You get a sense of what it was like to be in the huddle and to be in the locker room with guys like Unitas, with coaches like Lombardi, with people like George Halas, what it was like to negotiate your own contract. You learn about these nuances of what these guys had to do. They went in. I mean, you sat down with, you know, you sat down with Vince Lombardi, and he's like, you know, okay, let's talk contract. You know, I mean, you're trying to ask Vince Lombardi for a raise. That's a tough negotiator right there. So that is, plus you get a lot of backstories in the game. Like I just had talked about with the Jim Marshall play, you learn a lot of things like that. Plus you get a lot of good insight. You know, Elvin Bethea and Walt Garrison were very open about what they were looking for at the beginning of plays to try to see where their opponent was headed. And, you know, really you can tell if a pass is coming up just by the way the offensive linemen are lined up, by the way they place their hand. You can tell the direction a player is planning to run after the snap of the ball by the way he has his feet planted. So you do get a deeper knowledge of the game as well, what players look for. And it's really kind of incredible to watch football differently after you get some of these insights.
Yeah, getting insights really can give perspective as far as what's going on in the field. And then, of course, like I said, with the head coaches and going through their mind, sometimes I think we lose that as, we'll say, the generation that I grew up in with Madden always there, where it just seemed, well, all you got to do is press X and then that's the button and that guy's going to go that far and you're going to catch the ball and you're always going to get a touchdown. And that's always obviously not the case. But so Madden's been great, I think, for, and that's, by the way, to give you the one of the answers, that's my golden goose. If I were to be able to interview Madden, I would love that. But
yeah.
That's far between here. But at any rate, I love what Madden did for the game as far as the popularity for the broad spectrum of fans. But then at the same time, it did take away some of the realisticness, what's going on. I mean, Super NES, Bo Jackson knocking over the, I forgot, what's that linebacker's name again?
Brian Bosworth.
Boswell, yes, thank you. Yeah. That whole commercial there. But so that brings us into...
Well, that really did happen in a game. And Bo Jackson ran over a lot of people. He was hard to bring down.
Yeah, I've seen some highlights. And again, I'm not old enough to be able to have watched him live. Another guy that I wasn't able to watch live, which kind of somewhat will transition us into your next project, is Earl Campbell. You ever had those bratwursts or sausages, being that you're down from Texas, from Earl Campbell?
Well, I grew up in Wisconsin, so I am quite... Oh, right. So, yeah, I've had bratwursts. Now I know what you're saying. No, Earl owns a sausage company.
That's what it is. Sausage. Yeah. He's always at the store, and I got them one time, but it's like I can't recall the difference between if they were, how good they were compared to the others. But, yeah, I thought it was the coolest thing, this dude with a cowboy hat, and it says Earl Campbell right on the package.
Earl Campbell's Hot Links. Yeah.
That's what it was. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. He also owns a kind of restaurant at the airport in Austin. And, you know, kind of a funny story about that was they booked me to play at the airport, and they said, you can either play at the main stage or you could play, you know, at Earl Campbell's restaurant. And I was like, oh, I want to play at Earl Campbell's restaurant. Are you kidding me? And, so yeah, you know, that maybe not the best career choice, you know, to not play on the main stage, but yeah, I wanted to play at Earl Campbell's. It turns out his Heisman Trophy is there. So if you're ever, or at least it was then. So if you're ever in the Austin airport, you know, if the restaurant is still there, I mean, get Earl Campbell's sausage and you can see his Heisman Trophy there.
There you go. I went to, in Texarkana, the Billy Sims barbecue, being a Lions fan. Of course, I saw a sign. I had to stop there off there. But let's go back to your next project. We have the game before the money, and then you moved into kind of more localized, we'll call it one team specific. Let's talk about your next projects.
Yeah. So then the next two projects I did was I did a video documentary with the Love You Blue era Houston Oilers of the late 1970s. And then I just released a new book called Red, White, and Columbia Blue, Chasing the Dream with the 1979 Houston Oilers. So that just, the book just focuses solely on the 1979 season, game by game account with, you know, commentary from the players. And that again led to some magic. There was a, in watching football, there, Dan Pastorini, their quarterback, told me about the Oilers' offense and how it was designed for him to call plays at the line of scrimmage. And he talked about calling this play that turned out to be a 60-some yard touchdown run for Earl Campbell on Thanksgiving against the Dallas Cowboys. And it was magical because he told me what he was looking for on the play. I watched the Cowboys defense lined up and I saw the way the play went. It was incredible to watch, to know what the quarterback was thinking and to see it happen.
I was going to say, why that one year? Why that team? Why did you choose to write about them?
Yeah, because the Oilers, for one, they had an incredible amount of fan support. And anybody who remembers the Love You Blue era and what the Astrodome was like on television, I was watching it on television. But the crowd was so loud and so enthusiastic. So there was a love of the fans. And plus, the Oilers were kind of in a really uniquely unfortunate position in that the team of the 70s, the Pittsburgh Steelers, were in their division. So they not only, they had to play the Steelers twice a year, and then they'd have to play them again in the playoffs to get to the Super Bowl. It would kind of be like if the Miami Dolphins were arguably the second best team in the NFL during a given season, and then they'd have to go up against the Patriots three times and try to win the AFC championship at New England. But that team had four Hall of Famers, Earl Campbell. They had three on defense with Curly Culp, Elvin Bethea, and Robert Brazil. They had Bum Phillips as their head coach, who was a cowboy through and through. He owned a ranch, raised cattle. And the other thing that the players like to bring up, the defensive back Willie Alexander brought up in the documentary, We Were the Oilers. He said, hey, you know, this is the time when Urban Cowboy, the movie, was just coming out. And the Urban Cowboy fashion had taken off. So people were wearing cowboy hats all over the country. They were dressing in Western wear. And here, the Oilers had a head coach who was a rancher. You know, he'd wear a cowboy hat and boots on the sidelines. And this was in an era where most coaches wore suits on the sidelines. Now we're used to seeing the hooded sweatshirt, things like that. But he was cowboy hat and boots. And but the Oilers were a fantastic team. And I think that's important to cover. And again, their fan base, they had 60,000 people or more greet them at the Astrodome after they lost, get this, after they lost to the Steelers in the AFC Championship game. And that was more people. There were more people at the Astrodome to greet them than attended the game. That's pretty incredible. That shows you how special that team was.
Yeah, I'm too young to really remember the transition away from Houston. I was there. Of course, I remember the Music City Miracle and all that kind of thing, but I don't remember the details of why they left the city to move to Nashville. Is that something that you covered at all in any of your projects, or because I was too early in the whole game?
Yeah, I covered mostly the late 70s era, Oilers, the Love You Blue era. There was a big, that was the phrase. That was their slogan, Love You Blue. They had flashcards that they gave out before the Monday night game against the Steelers in 1979. That's the Love You Blue. And everybody in the crowd had these Love You Blue flashcards. In 1978, they gave out blue and white pom-poms. And everybody had those. And this is in an era before, like, you know, now you see sports teams, you know, sometimes they'll have fans wear, you know, the same color shirt. And you'll see the everybody wearing a white shirt or something in the stands. This is long before anybody was doing this. And so the Oilers were special in that way. And I also need to bring up the Mike Renfro play. And that's a real big reason on why to cover the 1979 season, is that it's one of the most controversial plays in NFL history. And the season really historically has been reduced to that one play. But that team had a lot of tenacity. They had a lot of great come from behind wins. They won two playoff games, one on the road without Earl Campbell, without Dan Pastorini, and without Kenny Burrow, who is their leading receiver. And they beat the Air Coryell Chargers on the road. And they beat the Cowboys in Dallas on Thanksgiving Day. That Oiler team was fantastic. And in fact, they still own the franchise record for biggest come from behind win. They were down 24-0 at Cincinnati and came back to win that game. So many special points of that season. And like I said before, so many special players, a special coach as well. And that special bond between the city of Houston and that team.
So you brought up a lot of different players all throughout history. And then right there, you kind of zoned in on, we'll call it the 70s right there for the Houston Oilers. I do have something that I ask every guest of this podcast where I give you the virtual keys to my DeLorean. You can go back in time, any point in history, maybe covering one of your moments in the book, whatever you want. Let's go to one moment. You can relive the moment yourself and then maybe even ask a question to the player or coach in that moment. Where are you going and what you're asking?
Oh boy. Wow. So not just watching the game as a fan in the stands.
I'm actually experiencing the moment, whether it's in the locker room, you're going to be in the huddle with one guy said he wanted to be in the huddle before the drive, because if you wanted just to see how cool he really was kind of thing, and just all these different types of interesting questions. So you're specific. You could go fanboy moment on me. You can go whatever it is. Let's go back in point in time. 88 miles an hour, baby.
Okay. I would say off the top of my head, Super Bowl 14, Rams Steelers, and talk to Terry Bradshaw and John Stallworth and Chuck Knoll about one that amazing touchdown that Terry Bradshaw threw to John Stallworth in the fourth quarter. And to talk to Chuck Knoll, just to talk about, you know, what his coaching style was, what it, you know, and get kind of some of his mindset. That would be off the top of my head. That would probably be it.
Okay. Well, I mean, with that, are there any other projects you have coming up that you want to share with the listener of the show?
Well, the Game Before the Money podcast is really high on my agenda. And also the gamebeforethemoney.com. So I do a lot through that website. So that project is ongoing, and I'm going to continue doing it for as long as I can. And, cause it's really important to document these stories, not only for the fans, but for the families as well, because, a lot of times, you know, it's kind of nebulous. They don't, you know, kids who are younger don't realize that their grandpa actually played for the Chargers or the Rams or the Steelers or whatever team. And that they had parts in historic moments of the National Football League. So, and then for us fans to kind of get an, like you said, kind of like sitting down at a bar and chatting with a player and getting that up close and personal, thing that, that you can't get anywhere else. And that's what I hope is that once people hear the podcast, or read the books, they kind of know the players as people as well, as learning some NFL history and some insights into the game.
There you go. What player would you pick to sit down in a bar with? That's a good question, because maybe you could take my DeLorean back and you can go to an old school player that existed way back in time, sit there in a bar, have a conversation with him, and just relive his own stories. Speaking of my DeLorean, and wanting to go back, again, I want to redo something else, because here's another peel the curtain moment for you that I didn't talk about at the beginning. Michael shared with me in the pregame emails that he could be credited with helping Drew Brees launch his career. Well, I kind of added a little bit of fluff to that story, because it wasn't really helping him launch his career, but when he was working at the local deli where Drew Brees went to high school, he said he would actually see him 2 to 3 times a week. And the reason why he really remembered it was because one day Drew came in wearing a Purdue hat. And at the time he says, "Dude, I'm going to Purdue." So not a bad way to start off your eventual, we'll call it, working with the NFL football career. And it's a bummer that I really forgot to ask him that question in the interview, because I would have loved to have heard it in his own words. So speaking of his own words, I'm going to tell you this. I mean, personally, I enjoy this conversation, and Michael had a whole bunch of cool stories for us, and maybe we'll bring him back on. We'll hear that Drew Brees story. We'll hear that Bart Starr calling him back story, and we'll hear some other stories. But again, before I let you go, don't forget about this book giveaway. This is a very interesting book. Like you said, Voices of the Men Who Helped Build the NFL. And to sign up for your entry, which again, you can have multiple entries into this, you can head to sportshistorynetwork.com/contest. But with that, I'm going to leave you there. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Football History Dude. To make sure you're the first to get the next episode, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice and head on over to thefootballhistorydude.com for the show notes and more information on the history of the NFL. And remember, dudes, where we're going, we don't need roads.